Just as you're getting used to the federal tax changes, here come the potential state tax changes. B&O tax, property tax cuts for seniors, maybe a sales tax holiday. Let's go to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott, who's been looking into this. Tell us about it.
So this is from Republican Representative Drew McEwen. He says he has got five tax reform bills about changing the way the state does business, starting with the B&O tax. He's got two proposals on that front.
One is to lower the manufacturing rate to be equal to the aerospace industry and make that across the board for all manufacturers. I believe that it's the fair and the right thing to do to ensure that anybody in a given sector has the same rate as anyone else.
So this lowers the manufacturing B&O tax rate for all manufacturers 40%, giving all of them the same deal Boeing and others in aerospace get. It's not a new idea. In fact, it's one both Democrats and Republicans okayed just a couple of years ago in a last-minute budget deal, but that was ultimately vetoed by the governor. So wouldn't it be reasonable to think that that would happen again?
There's always that possibility, for sure. I think when you look at what's going on in our state, we're losing competition-wise to states like Oregon. And this affects everything from breweries to the timber industry to large manufacturing. So, is it a possibility the governor would veto it again? Yes, it would. But I would hope that in the legislature we can muster enough strength to overcome a veto.
And it did get overwhelmingly passed the last time. It's not clear why it didn't get that two-thirds override veto vote that when the governor did that. So we'll see how that progresses. His other proposal targeting the B&O tax?
Have a standard deduction for all businesses of $1 million. So if your gross revenue is $1 million or less, you would not be paying a B&O tax. And I think this is important to help our small and medium-sized businesses have enough time to incubate and grow before having the burden of paying a tax on gross receipts when they may not even be making money yet.
Both of those ideas run counter to what the governor is proposing in his budget, of course, which is a 1% increase in the B&O tax overall. And McEwen says that's the point of his ideas. He just dropped both of those bills, and he's still working on getting a hearing, but he does believe that he's going to get some Democrats on board.
So I'll phrase it this way. There's bipartisan support for B&O tax reform. We all agree that it's a system that's not fair. Maybe a component of this bill in conjunction with others. And I'm fine with doing that. I don't care whose name is first on a bill. Let's get something done here, and let's provide relief to the businesses in this state.
I mean, the B&O tax is unfair because it doesn't account for profit. It only accounts for gross revenue.
The only fair way
to do it would be an income tax, but nobody wants the income tax. I hear this every single year.
Every single year. There's chatter, and not a lot of it came out of this yesterday, but over in the Senate, there's a proposal for a work group to look at various other ways to deal with our tax system, possibly an income tax as well. We'll see how that goes. Another thing he's looking to get relief for, though, is property taxes for seniors.
What the intent of this bill is to help to provide a level of certainty for property taxes for seniors. So once you hit age 65, the first $250,000 of your home, whatever the tax is at that point, would stay put. It would not go up further. And in doing that, as a senior, now you know that portion of your property taxes is going to be stable for as long as you own that home. This only applies to your primary residence, and you have to be a resident of the state.
Now, that bill does have a Democratic co-sponsor. It also got a hearing.
That'd be for anybody over 65?
Anybody over 65 who lives, a resident of the state, and that's their primary home, right? So then if you have a home that's $250, mm-hmm. worth $250, you never pay any property tax. And if it's over $250, then you pay on whatever above $250.
Love that idea.
Yeah, and again, that's what I said. And it's got a Democratic co-sponsor, got a hearing this week, along with some other bills to give some relief for veterans and things. And so he told me that he thought that this might end up being a piece of a larger package that may end up getting done. So I'll keep an eye on that for everybody. Another one of his proposals that does have bipartisan support is a 3-day sales tax holiday for back to school supplies and clothing.
I think that's important that young families are just trying to get started in life and have a strong footing to provide some relief there that they can get these items done.
And finally, he wants the sales tax from car purchases to actually go to the transportation budget rather than into the general fund.
This is a significant amount of revenue. We can't do this overnight, and that's why it's phased in over a number of years so that on the state budget side, on the operating side, we can adjust, make the changes needed within the operating budget to accommodate that.
And he says his proposals don't increase any taxes, unlike some ideas being considered for from Senate Transportation Chair Steve Hobbs, like a carbon fee or a gas tax increase to pay for transportation. So we'll see how this goes. I see Sully cheering over here about the transportation budget.
Everybody wants more money for roads.
And then that frees, you know, takes it out of the general fund. So we'll see how those progress. A couple of those in the middle, the property tax for seniors, the sales tax holiday, do have some Democratic co-sponsors already. But he sounds like he's having a lot of conversations trying to get these things heard. He just dropped some of these a couple of days ago, so we'll see how they go.
Very good. By the way, when you say drop, that means into the hopper.
Yes.
It sounds like they're not doing it anymore, but dropped in legislative speak means it's been proposed.
It has been proposed, right, and introduced.
Thank you, Hannah. This is Seattle's Morning News. One question I'm sure a lot of you are asking is whether the Trump administration is about to go to war in Venezuela. And the latest crisis was set in motion when Nicolas Maduro won what appears to have been an illegitimate election and declared himself president for six more years, plus the economic collapse down there, which has led to inflation of 1.7 million% based on the latest figures I saw. So I thought we would call as somebody who has studied this area for many years. Michael Hogan is an historian, a teacher, teaches at the American School in Guadalajara, Mexico. He's the chairman emeritus of the humanities department. You've written how many books? 24?
24, huh?
So bring us up to date. Explain to me why a country like Venezuela, with this huge oil resource, has hyperinflation and people who are literally starving, and millions now leaving the country as refugees.
Well, this is not the first time that this type of thing has happened. Historically, when the price of oil falls, Venezuela runs into major problems. It was doing quite well under the Hugo Chavez administration until 2015, when the price of oil dropped dramatically. And when that happened, all of the programs that were being funded through the sale of the export of oil and began to suffer. This also happened back in the 50s. It happened in the 60s. I don't know if you remember. I think you're probably too young. But in 1958, when Nixon went to Venezuela, which was then under the conservative government of Pérez Jiménez, there were riots in the streets, and Nixon barely escaped with his life. His limousine was attacked. The windows were actually broken.
Wow.
And, he almost, didn't get out of there alive.
That is one of the few things I am too young to remember. You're right. So this is not just a symptom of socialism?
The real problem in Venezuela was the fact that, 90% of their exports is in petroleum. And you can't run an economy based on a single export.
So would anything be helped if the United States gets involved here? We recognize the opposition, Juan Guaido. But he doesn't have the loyalty of the army, so what should our next move be?
I think the best thing the United States can do is stay out of it. You know, one of the things that's going on now is Mexico and Uruguay, which are neutral nations, have approached Maduro and said, you've got to sit down with the opposition and you've got to come to an agreement.
And you have this refugee problem, which, of course, could eventually end up at our own border. So we don't have any skin in the game?
I think anything we do at this point is going to be seen negatively, both by the rest of the world and certainly by the Venezuelans themselves.
Okay, so then how does this end?
I think one of the unfortunate things is that, you sometimes get leaders that stay beyond where they should be and even change the Constitution to do that. And that's not capitalism and that's not socialism. That's just dictatorial, individuals who get in their hands that they want to hold on to power. And I think regime change might be what's called for, but I think that has to be internal. I think it has to be internal, or at least with their closest neighbors, making decisions, not with, not with the Yankees doing it. Because many of the problems that we have in Latin America today are caused by historical interference in the by the United States.
Right, which you've written about extensively, including our Mexican-American War, which we started, and which, according to your book, Abraham Lincoln stood up and opposed, even though it got him called a traitor.
Exactly. When President Polk said, we need to invade Mexico because American blood has been shed on American soil, he said, you know, Polk is a liar. Show me the spot where American blood was shed. You know, it was Mexican blood that was shed first, and we are the invaders, and it was on Mexican soil. And he kept on repeating, show me the spot, show me the spot. And even the newspapers in Illinois began calling him Spotty Lincoln. And of course, he didn't get reelected to the House. And when he ran for the Senate, he was defeated as well. And he went back to his law firm, and he pretty much considered that his political career was over. So it was a very risky thing for him to do, but he did. In 1863, which is the second part of the book, he's very busy with the Civil War. We have Antietam, we have Gettysburg, and so on and so forth. And he's approached by the exiled Mexican ambassador by the name of Romero. And Romero says, can you help Mexico out? We're being invaded by the French. They've imposed Maximilian on the throne. And Lincoln says, well, I can't do anything overtly to help you because, you know, France is an erstwhile ally, and if I alienate them, they'll join the Confederacy, and then we'll lose. He said, but clandestinely, I will help you. And he gave him a letter that he could use to go to bankers. And Romero was able to raise $18 million to aid the exiled forces of Juarez and ultimately defeat the French.
So given how much you've written about Mexico, I should ask you, what do you think about our current policy? Would a wall make any difference or not?
No. You know, I think there's all kinds of technology that can be useful in terms of sealing up the areas that are still, you know, problematic. But most of the smuggling that takes place at border control stations, and that's where you need to kind of improve your technology and your search devices. You know, in terms of the attraction to immigrants, there's been bills proposed in Congress during the Bush administration, which were reasonable and made sense, but they've been, you know, set aside every year because of political reasons. America just has to develop the political will to say how we want to deal with our borders.
Historian and author Dr. Michael Hogan, his book about Abraham Lincoln's attempt to stop the Mexican-American War, I don't know if that's even taught in schools anymore, but that's how, that's when we took, I mean, just took Texas, part of Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, and California from Mexico. One of the reasons we got off to a bad start with that country. So for any teachers listening, he runs what's called the Lincoln and Mexico Project, and that provides free e-copies of the book, so you can add that to the curriculum if you're allowed to. Just Google Lincoln and Mexico. Lincoln and Mexico.
Time for your daily dose of kindness. For Alfonso Garcia, it was a normal day at work as a custodian at the L.A. Memorial Coliseum until he was asked by the general manager to go into his office. CBS reports that Garcia was a little nervous of being called into the boss's office, saying, that's not an office you want to go into. But fear dissolved into disbelief when he saw the team had wide receiver Brandon Cooks waiting for him, and that's when he got the good news. Brandon presented Garcia with the special gift of two tickets to the Super Bowl. He tweeted this video of his joyous reaction.
You mean so much to us, and you know that you're special, what you do around here, and everything that you do does not go unnoticed. So.
Oh, my God.
One more time for you and your son. Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's a dream come true, man.
Absolutely.
Oh, my God.
And he's taking his son, Josh. The Rams tweeted that it takes a team to achieve the dream and that Garcia keeps our facility in tip-top shape.
Well done. Well done indeed. Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. And here he is, freshly sprung from that den of insiders, Danny O'Neill. Super Bowl hype is at, we're at peak Super Bowl hype. Right about now.
Are you sure? It feels like this year is a little understated.
Well, because we're not involved in
it. It's a division rival. It's the hated Patriots. You root for food poisoning. I don't know.
we were all reminiscing about how much fun it was in 2014. The game before the game then was to get Marshawn Lynch to say something. But
I'm here so I won't get fined.
We had that memorable moment. Deion Sanders tried to, what is that, a hear-to-hear with Marshawn?
You just don't want to talk, really.
I'm just about that action, boss.
Heart-to-heart, that's what I'm supposed to say. Thank you. It was a heart-to-heart. Anyway, there aren't really great characters this year, are there?
No. Well, Gronkowski's a pretty good character. Big Rob Gronkowski. You don't like him? He's the big... he's the Mimbo. He's the male...
The one non-quarterback guy I've heard of.
Right.
You've been Gronked, right?
Big fun-loving guy who said, "Yo soy fiesta," in his bilingual version. That's correct. The literal translation would be, "I am party."
Okay. I think it was some milk.
How it would be? No. Yo soy, I am party is what... He's a lovable kind of character. But yeah, both teams are fairly understated. You've got the youngest coach, one of the older coaches, but there's not as much drama and buildup in this game for sure.
That's too bad. Which means that the big news is the Commissioner Roger Goodell news conference.
Yeah, not really though. You'd probably be better equipped for this than anybody else. This is the politician stepping up to the podium in the midst of a controversy in which they proceed to move their lips and make words and sequence
the
words.
Which controversy are we talking about? The non-call the Colin Kaepernick thing?
Well, it's mostly the non-call. The Colin Kaepernick thing, if anybody expected him to definitively answer that, I mean, we're 2 years removed from him being in the league now. So, of course, he's going to say teams would sign him if they thought he would help them win, which is patently. I mean, at this point, you're like, okay, you're telling me the sky's purple. That's what it is, and I don't expect you to confess to the sky being blue, because for 2 years you've denied that the sky is blue.
So on the non-call controversy, he did say something about using video replays to correct non-calls as well as calls.
That's correct. Having an eighth official, perhaps, that is as opposed to just video review, but someone who is watching on video to potentially use it. But then he also said that eighth person will be a human being. So that human being will also be capable of mistakes. So that sort of they may expand it. Judging from what he said, they're not going to expand instant replay to include judgment calls.
So in other words, there is no official watching video in real time.
He's not capable of making any calls.
But
that's
he can't
correct.
Make any calls.
Right. There's in the command center. They have a command center in New York, which has a communication with the referee.
Right.
But nobody is in charge of, I'm watching the video screen and I'm capable of making and telling the official, hey, I saw this.
Hey, let the play-by-play guys do it. They're watching in real time.
No, you don't trust them. I do not want Joe Buck making play-by-play, like any sort of officiating calls.
No? Some of the color guys are lawyers now, aren't they?
Well, some of them are former players, all sorts of things. But no, they're not trained officials. Sometimes they complain about the length of games. I could see someone wanting to get and catch their flight and impacting it in that way.
You need a former trained official in the play-by-play booth.
No, they got those too, and those guys are terrible because they basically explain to you all the different ways officiating is difficult and why the officials are always right.
That's the part of the game I find most interesting.
The officiating?
When they have the legal arguments.
No.
Did he touch the ground
at a certain
second? It's like trying to diagnose an auto accident.
Yeah, because one-handed catches stink, huh?
Yeah,
it's terrible to watch a guy throw a football 50 yards down the field and put it into a 5-gallon bucket, essentially.
Oh, it's amazing.
That's why we watch the game. It's not amazing for the stupid pinstripes.
But it's got to be legal.
No.
Danny, it's only amazing if it's legal. Anybody can do a spectacular catch in practice. But it's doing it in this environment that's got competition and big guys hitting other big guys and all these rules you got to follow at the same time. And what's a catch and which part of the other guy can you touch and all that stuff. The fact you could actually complete the pass in that kind of environment, that's the amazing thing.
Now, you would have gone to Clarence Darrow and watched him try a case, and you would have come away like, he really introduced the exhibits well. Come on! It's one of the great orders. We're watching the world's best athletes playing a game. I don't want to see it boiled down to some legalese argument about whether or not there was actually the interpretation
was correct. Well, that's where we'll have to differ. Speaking of great athletes, Husky men's basketball team has won 10 in a row now?
Heck yeah. Matisse Thybulle, he was a monster last night. Noah Dickerson with one of his better games of the season. They beat a USC team that was talented but undisciplined, would be my summary of them. They led start to finish. It was impressive.
So this is back to the glory days.
Well, if we ever had glory days. Oh. I mean, there have been sporadically few, Dave. We're a football school. But this has rekindled optimism and hope. Down on Montlake. Maybe we'll get past the round of the Sweet 16, which hasn't happened.
How about that, huh?
Yeah, we haven't seen that in a long time. There was the 1950s where they went, but that was before the
tournament.
Those
were the glory days.
Yeah, before color television? I don't know.
Oh, those were the good.
If it didn't happen in March Madness, did it really occur?
If it didn't happen on I Love Lucy, we didn't see it.
I'm excited. This team is a lot of fun to watch. They've all of a sudden learned to shoot, which is pretty remarkable because David Crisp was not a good shooter. Now he can't miss from the outside.
It's essential to basketball.
Yeah, and Matisse Thybulle's Spider-Man. He's so long, athletic. He never seems to get tired. Plus, he's got a great dimple.
Excellent.
Absolutely fantastic dimple.
I'm very happy for him and for the team. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Seattle is looking into the possibility of tolling city streets or congestion pricing, and one state lawmaker wants to put the brakes on that idea before the proposal can even come up. And Car Radio's Hannah Scott is here to explain that for us. Hannah.
When Senator Tim Shelton introduced a bill to block any city from imposing tolls earlier this month, he admitted at the time it was unlikely to pass. It did, however, get a hearing yesterday, and he made no secret about his target.
Mayor Durkin has announced she has a task force working on this. Of course, they call it congestion management. I call it tolling. To me, is unfair, especially to low-income people.
Bryce Aden with the Transportation Choices Coalition came out to oppose the plan, warning how important it was to keep all options open for Seattle.
One of the reasons why they're looking at it is due to the 99 tunnel and some of the diversion and the impacts that that might cause through their heart of their downtown. We're in the middle of maximum constraint currently, and it's only going to get worse in the next couple of months, I suppose, to continue through until some Sound Transit projects are finished.
But he said it's about more than the city of Seattle.
Holistically, we look at this in terms of finding options for local jurisdictions to address the needs on their city streets, on their sidewalks, and other infrastructure needs that they have. We just don't want to see this move forward because we want to keep those options open.
Jane Wall over at the Association of Counties had similar concerns, and she told the committee counties are seeing much, much less revenue over the past several years, and that you expect that to continue.
The gas tax has been relatively flat for counties over the past 20 years. And as you heard from the treasurer's office last week, as we look towards the future and the electrification of our transportation grid, there are real concerns that that motor vehicle fuel tax will continue to decline. We're very worried about future revenues. We're worried about the revenues now and future revenues. And to use the cliche term, we just really need all the tools in our toolbox to be able to anticipate how we're going to pay for future road needs.
And she said that goes double for another of Sheldon's proposals to bar road use charges in rural counties or a pay-by-mile system like the pilot program the state is running right now.
Rural counties obviously have more distance to drive to work, to for family issues. We drive farther. I've surveyed my constituents in the 35th district on this issue, and hardly any support for a road usage charge, vehicle miles charge. The method of collection, many people think, would be very invasive. Method of collection could also show up any traffic violations you might have when you're making an illegal left-hand turn or parking the wrong way.
Rima Griffith with the Transportation Commission says, look, they get there's a lot of anxiety around this idea.
However, given that 30 of the 39 counties would fall under this, banning RUC in rural counties would leave the gas tax as a primary source of revenue for rural counties or rural parts of our state, leaving rural drivers disproportionately impacted by future gas tax rate increases and denying them the opportunity to lower their proportionate share of taxes.
And she suggested that the Senate hold off on any decision on that particular bill until the report from this pilot program comes out. That'll be in 2020. The pilot, I believe, wraps up this week.
So are all the roads in great shape? People are happy with them?
I don't think so.
Well, then where did the money to come from? I don't understand. I just heard every single option pretty much dismissed, including an extra tax. So I guess we'll just give people whatever amount of road they've paid for. So the richer counties will get more roads and the poorer counties will get gravel.
And I think what Senator Patton said during this is there such a thing as a progressive way to do a road tax? They're concerned about the impact, especially with tolls on low-income people, especially in Seattle, that it would just prevent low-income people from being able to drive in the city. And there was no solution that I heard yesterday.
It's all good. The whole progressive solution is you, of course, tax the people who are most easily able to pay. But we do not want to do that in this state.
Well, and how do you do that specific to roads?
You have an income road tax, I guess.
Yes.
Tax the income of each driver. You used to tax the cars based on their, you still tax the cars based on their value, which is sort of a proxy for an income tax, but people hate that as well.
Yeah.
So I like the idea of just having a vending machine approach where at the traffic lights, you're stopped there, you can insert a card and, whichever side of the intersection pays the most gets the green light first. And that way, you can suck some money out of people who can afford it.
This is not a dessert dash at a high school charity.
Can that, I do the remote?
That doesn't work that way.
I know. It's the only way I can figure out that people will actually be willing to pay for something is if you deny it to them if they don't pay it, right?
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. And it's like the express toll lanes, right? Like, I go in the express toll lanes and pay however much the $10 it is because I want to not wait.
Yeah.
You mean the $10 that was only supposed to be rarely, but
rarely.
What it is every day?
Yes, I do mean that.
You mean that one?
Yeah. I do.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Rachel Bell, who is going to help those of you who plan to have a Super Bowl hangover. I guess nobody plans to have a hangover, but sometimes you celebrate too much. I celebrated too much once in 1968.
And we're still talking about it.
That's right.
Yeah, one should always plan for a hangover, Dave. That's why I thought you'd have more of them, because you seem like a regimented kind of planning
That's
person.
That's right. I would plan it out, yes.
Yes. Well, today is also the last day of Dryuary, which is now the portmanteau that represents people giving up alcohol for the month of January.
Oh.
Kind of like a alcohol fast. So
That's
tomorrow,
why the bars are so empty.
But then February 1st then becomes the day that everybody gets drunk. So you may have a hangover on February 2nd. So there's a guy named Shaughnessy Bishopstall, and he wrote a book called Hungover, The Morning After and One Man's Quest for a Cure. And he spent the last decade, allegedly for researching this book, getting drunk and testing out hangover remedies from the ancient to the modern. So before we get into this, I think it's important to talk about what happens to the body when you have a hangover so
yes.
that you understand some of these cures. So when you overdrink, your body's immune system starts overreacting and it decides that you have dangerous toxicity inside. And so it's like, get it out, get it out. So one of the biggest symptoms is that you get intense inflammation of your cells and your internal organs. And this means that it's impossible for your organs to allow liquid and nutrients to enter them. Everything just kind of gets blocked off, which is why you're thirsty and dehydrated. So let's start with some of the ancient remedies that he researched and tried.
There's the ancient Anglo-Saxon remedy of putting hemlock in your socks and walking around all day. There's a old Puerto Rican cures involving putting a wedge of a lime in your armpit and squeezing it.
Ugh.
Also a great way to make a stinky margarita. So a lot of people are in the habit of going out for a greasy breakfast the day after they drink. And it sounds like that's not off course entirely, because there's something special in chicken eggs that actually can make a hangover better.
If you look at what we've been eating for breakfast for thousands of years throughout Western history, it's always had to do with eggs. And it turns out that chicken eggs have an amino acid in them called N-acetyl-L-cysteine, which is about as close as I've come to almost a magical ingredient when it comes to curing hangovers. You can also look at Victorian chimney sweeps who around Christmas time used to make extra money by selling little pouches of soot that you were supposed to then dissolve in warm milk and drink down before getting drunk. If you look at charcoal tablets, which are given to people who overdose in emergency rooms, they, of course, have a filtering aspect to them to filter out the toxins in a body.
So he says One way that you can treat a hangover that should make it 50% better is to eat eggs that have that enzyme and to eat burnt toast that would act as kind of that soot.
So breakfast was designed as a hangover cure by our perpetually drunk ancestors.
You've got it, Dave. So like I said, it won't cure it entirely, as everybody knows, because I personally don't believe that there is an actual cure, because I've never encountered one. But on a research trip to Vegas, he did find that there is one
research
thing.
Research trip to Vegas.
Uh-huh. Well, they have these hangover, quote, hangover doctors.
Oh, I'm sure.
There. Yeah, where they'll hook you up to, what's it called when you go to the hospital and you get the drip?
The IV drip.
The IV drip, which you can get on the east side here for a hangover cure. But anyway, There's one thing you can do that actually will wipe out your hangover entirely instantaneously.
And one of the things I did was jump off the Stratosphere, which is, I think, one of the tallest freestanding buildings in the world. And you jump off it, attach these cords, and it kind of blew the hangover right out of me. And that's when I started doing more experiments around adrenaline.
So after you jumped, was your hangover just gone?
Yeah, that one seemed to almost entirely reboot my system, much in the same way as it did when I found these glacial lakes to jump into, where it's basically sub-zero water, so it's water that should be frozen, and so it drives your body into an extreme state of adrenaline, similar to jumping off a tall building. It's hard to replicate those massive doses of adrenaline without a spike to your veins. But there seemed to be a point at which a sort of rebooting effect would happen.
Of course, not
just put your body into shock, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But when you have a hangover and you're in bed or you're on the couch, you're not in the mood to go find a glacial lake or to go jump off of a stratosphere or to another thing he did, drive a car at a very fast speed. He did find his
These all sound like things that you do when you're still drunk.
Exactly. But it is interesting to know. I mean, I'm sure it has to do with ancient man, and if you needed to run away from something, that adrenaline would snap you out of whatever mode you're in, be it sleep or if you're sick or if you're hungover and you just need to go. So it is interesting to know there is one cure. He did come up with his own concoction, taking things here and there from all these different remedies. And he has this in the book if you want exact amounts. It's a mix of amino acid supplements, three very particular vitamin Bs, a couple different magnesiums, and a natural anti-inflammatory that doesn't tax the liver, which Tylenol does. So he uses frankincense. And you have to take this mixture between drinking and going to sleep.
I think I'd rather jump off the stratosphere.
You don't want to make a witchy potion?
No. The only thing that's left out is Eye of Newt and Foot of Toad or something.
Ooh, I like all of this. Yeah. He feels kind of bad that he wrote the book in the first place because he says he doesn't really want to give people a way out because you shouldn't be drinking like this in the first place.
Oh, I think his cures are deterrent enough. Car Radio's Rachel Bell. So what are your suggestions?
I've occasionally had a hangover, maybe. Uh-huh. Towards the end of the night, I try to prevent it in the front end by going drink water in between towards the end. And then at the end, I pound like a gallon of water. That generally doesn't always seem to work because I keep getting up in the middle of the night for obvious reasons. The other one, four words, hair of the dog.
Yeah,
I don't really recommend that, but
just wake up.
So, like,
wake up
what would be a hair of the dog? What would be that for you?
Well, you know, just whatever, you know, whatever you got.
Whatever's
I remember
on
during
hand.
My one big spring break in college, that one really seemed to work because I was able to get right up and get going. Of course, I was 21 at the time, not what I am now. But yeah, I try to prevent it on the front end by curtailing towards the end of the night. You know, I start with good beer, then tail off to worse, lighter beer towards the end, which I know is sacrilege to some, and then I pound a bunch of water and try to prevent it on the front end.
Why don't they just add the charcoal to the beer up front?
Well, in some breweries these days,
sure
I'm sure there
out
is.
Out in the market next year.
I mean, I'm sure they probably put it in there. Yeah. I mean, considering what concoctions are out there these days. But, yeah, I give it a go.
Choke Points. Let's go. Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. Let's talk motorcycle helmets. And motorcycle lane splitting. The legislature is going to consider making it legal.
Well, yeah, there are a couple of different things going on here with that. And I want to talk about the helmet use before, because I went back and wasn't really quite aware of the whole history of the helmet rule here in the state. And they were required by law first in 1967, but then there was an uproar, and 10 years later, that law was repealed. Then the mandate returned in 1987, but only for people 17 or under. And then in 1990, they were back. Okay, everybody is required to wear the helmet. So the debate is back. And so a Senate bill would create a 3-year pilot project that would allow riders who are 21 years of age or older the ability to ride without helmets. It would be up to their choice. If the riders did choose to go without, they would be required to carry liability insurance. That's something that's not required now.
Can I ask you about that?
Yeah.
What's the reason for that?
Well, they tried to hash that out during the hearing, and it got into the minutia with the automotive industry and the insurance industry. But it's basically to provide some insurance for the damage that you do to that to the other car, or perhaps,
because you don't have a helmet.
Well, I was trying to figure out why. I think it's just a reason to provide an incentive for, hey, if you're going to do this, it's going to have to cost you something for that choice.
As a driver, I have to have liability
that
insurance.
That is correct.
But motorcycles do not?
No, they do not.
I see.
So if they hit you, chances are you just have to sue the driver, sue the rider individually. They're not required to carry it. But I think it's kind of a way of saying, hey, if you want your helmet, you have to pay something in that. And so Mark Riker, one of the many riders who testified in favor of this.
I've been riding a long time. I feel I'm a fairly responsible person. I'm asking continue to trust me with that responsibility.
And the writers all came back to one thing. It's freedom. It's freedom. I want the ability to do this. If, you know, if I screw up my head, it's my own darn fault. And Scott Robinson, a writer of 40 years and an Army vet, I think pretty much summed it up really well.
Someone says they are trying to keep us safe. I wanted to be safe. I would not be on a motorcycle. Many other veterans, motorcycle riders, feel the same way. We put our lives on the line to fight for our freedom. We did not go to war to be safe. We went there so we could be free to make a personal choice in how we live our life.
Now, as you would imagine, there was a lot of pushback. Washington State Patrol is against this and others as well. But Thurston County Sheriff John Snaza has a very personal connection to this because going helmetless almost killed him.
We don't ever expect bad things to happen. And unfortunately, I'm one of those guys. I was in a state where I didn't have to wear a helmet, and it happened to me.
Snaza was in Montana when he lost it at high speed and went off a 60-foot cliff.
I do agree that we all should have insurance. I was a lucky guy. I do have insurance, but that didn't help me from suffering a traumatic brain injury, breaking all the ribs on my left side, and breaking my neck.
So he made a very compelling case at this hearing, and that was only back in 2016. He admits, you know, whether or not the helmet would have, you know, prevented all the rest of those injuries, yeah. But certainly the traumatic
brain injury. I can see requiring
them
to have medical insurance,
yeah,
because,
or something
so
like
they don't
that.
Become a burden on society when they break their neck.
Yeah, so it's something that they're refining. Yeah. I mean, this is the first time we've kind of seen this as a shot across the bow. The other thing we're talking about is lane splitting, and for those that don't know what that is, it's the practice of riding your motorcycle between lanes of traffic. It usually happens when the traffic is backed up, and as you, motorcycles are air-cooled engines, so if they sit there idling, they just get ridiculously hot and burn. So, you know, keeping them going, it's only allowed in one place in the U.S., and that's California. They passed the law last year. But the Senate bill that's up right now would allow limited lane splitting. They'd only be able to do it on the far left-hand lane of any road, basically between your door as a car and the shoulder. So not traditional lane splitting. And a lot of riders said they don't like that idea because it puts them in an unsafe position. Most people aren't expecting you on your left, and they are certainly worried about all the debris that piles up on that side of the road.
And I am absolutely opposed to this particular bill. There's no statistics or no studies showing that riding on the left shoulder where riders or other motor vehicles are not going to be looking for traffic, to restrict them to stay within that lane in very limited space with no out, I think is very flawed.
And this bill would only allow bikers to go 25 miles an hour when doing lane splitting and no more than 10 miles an hour faster than the traffic that's there. Again, this would be a pilot project. A similar bill came up last year, slightly different than this one, didn't really get very far. There's a lot of opposition to this, but it's, you know, we have a lot of riders in this area, especially, I mean, you wait till the weather gets good around, you know, May, they really start coming out. People love doing it. So these are issues that they take personally, and they'd like to see some change, but they're not too confident yet about the way they're formulated now.
Would it be safer to let them just sort of scoot down the emergency lane?
Well, it's possible, but then again, that's where people break, you know, that's the breakdown lane if you have a problem. And again, this is not designed for, you know, at freeway speed traffic, but, you know, they're looking at multiple ideas, but the one that Washington seems to be dead set on is keeping them on the far left, which then doesn't help them get off at their exits to the right unless they're in downtown Seattle.
But, going down through the center of a jammed freeway also seems problematic to me.
Yeah, it does, but when at the speeds that you would generally be doing that and with the cars not going as fast.
Is there any room anymore? I mean, the lanes in the state have got shrunk.
Well, it's
so much.
I wouldn't recommend doing it on the Aurora Bridge because your windshield, both of your mirrors would be hitting each other. But on a standard highway with a 12-foot lane, yeah, there's room.
How is it working in California?
Well, the one thing that the State Patrol has said there, what they're seeing is people are doing it much faster than they're supposed to, and they can't enforce it when they do because they're on a motorcycle and they tear through the backup, and the police officers are stuck in the traffic, or even with their motorcycles, they can't get through, and they're gone.
So it's not working too well.
Not great for people who break the law when they do it, certainly.